switch.
Next matter before us is Dwayne Oliver Winslow versus Commonwealth. Ms. Randolph, is that right?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is actually Dusty Sparrow. I'm standing in for Ms. Randolph.
All right.
From the Office of Public Defender for Arlington County.
We're glad to have you. Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
All right.
Your Honor, this case is calling into question the sufficiency of a larceny conviction based upon fingerprint evidence. The victim stated that the cash and two laptops were stolen from his vehicle during a three-hour period his car was parked in a parking garage in Arlington County. And Dwayne Oliver Winslow's fingerprint was matched by a fingerprint expert to a latent print found on the metal box containing the cash that was allegedly stolen from that box.
May I interrupt you for a moment? Two statements made to the trial court caught my attention on this issue, and that is in the argument made, Ms. Randolph said, at best, the Commonwealth's evidence proved that he stole the money, but not the computers. And that caught my attention because that sounds like a concession, because on review, appellate review, that's exactly what the standard is. We look at the evidence at its best, you know, light most favorable. I thought, well, maybe that was an offhand remark. You know, maybe she shouldn't be skewered for that. But then there's another statement at page 118, PDF page 118 of the oral argument to the court, where the argument is made, this court should have only found him guilty of the petty larceny and not the grand larceny. Well, maybe that was a perfectly appropriate tactical argument to have made under the circumstances of the trial, and I'm not implying anything that it was not. But we would be in a very difficult position to say this trial judge erred in accepting what appears to be a direct concession on this very point. Wouldn't that be hard to explain to a trial judge?
Your Honor, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, if I may address the second alleged concession. I believe that was at a three-judge panel argument, and I believe there were two assignments of error, and one of them essentially asserted that there was no evidence connecting him to the laptops.
Actually, what I'm reading from is the hearing on June 21, 2013, before the Circuit Court of Arlington, and...
I understand. Okay. Thank you. So this was before the appellate stage. Okay.
Yeah, so Graham Williams was trial counsel at that hearing, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
For the
she
defendant?
Was retained.
Okay. Well, she conceded also that there were his fingerprints on the box, so, and that was conceded elsewhere as well. So the debate on appeal as to whether or not there's some reasonable concern as to whether or not the fingerprinting analysis was sound seems to be sidelined as well. But once again, how could we possibly write an appellate opinion saying that no rational fact finder judge, trial judge, could have concluded that you could find that he stole this money when it appears that his own attorney twice said, well, at best, it does show that. In fact, you should have found him of stealing the money, but not the computers.
I don't have the exact statements to which you're referring in front of me, but I think, starting with Ms. Randolph's statement, I think you said it said, at best, he could have been found guilty of petty larceny, and which is different than should. And so I don't believe on the appeal there's any concession that he even should be found guilty of a petty larceny.
Well, I'll give you the page. This is page 7 of the joint appendix, and it is a written motion filed by Mr. Winslow's counsel, Graham Williams. And it's a motion to set aside the verdict, which is actually what we're reviewing on appeal. And in the motion it says, in sum, the Commonwealth's evidence shows that, at best, Mr. Winslow committed petty larceny as it relates to the $20 taken from the cash box that his fingerprint was found on. It does not, however, show that he's responsible for taking the laptop computers. If I were a trial judge hearing that, I would hear, okay, they're conceding sufficiency for petty, but they're not conceding sufficiency for grand. So I don't have to worry about the 20 bucks in the box, but I do have to worry about deciding the laptops, which is a separate question, which we actually didn't grant the petition on. Now, if you couple that with actually the oral argument, it means sometimes the written pleadings vary a little bit. The oral argument says, this court should have only found him guilty of petty larceny and not grand larceny. But you're arguing on appeal, they shouldn't have found him guilty of petty larceny because the evidence is insufficient.
Well, where you have two different types of evidence at trial, you have the laptops and the cash, the court is aware. And value is also an issue.
We didn't grant the petition on value, though.
Correct. And so I think as we focus on just the sufficiency of whether a fingerprint evidence is sufficient to support the conviction for grand larceny, we evaluate it based on the fingerprint evidence as being whether or not it's sufficient. I wouldn't take that as any kind of concession, because I would look for the words, we concede that. But I think when someone is saying at best, it is kind of similar to saying assuming arguendo. And that's probably a term.
When you tell a trial judge, you should have convicted my client for petty larceny, that's different from telling that appellate court, you should not have convicted my client of any larceny, including petty larceny. That's different, right? I mean, I'm trying not to make something out of nothing, but it seems to me it's a pretty big deal.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think, I really believe when the statement is, in sum, the Commonwealth's evidence shows at best, meaning in any kind of
I think she
argues well before that the fingerprint evidence is insufficient to support the conviction, period. But
so you're basically saying that she's arguing in the alternative. Suggesting, Judge, you shouldn't convict my client of anything. However, if there is an inclination to convict, at best, the Commonwealth gets this.
Correct.
Okay.
And that also results in the two assignment of errors, which, as your honors noticed, we didn't get the second issue granted on value. And so I would just submit to the court that it's not a concession. It's just a second argument.
If Judge Kelsey is satisfied with your response, I'd like to move on to the circumstances that you suggest do not equate to a finding of guilt. Obviously, the case law suggests that just mere fingerprints, that doesn't necessarily get you where you need to be most of the time. And the case law seems to suggest that there has to be other circumstances, I believe is a term that is used in the case law, to suggest guilt. Here, the evidence established the metal box is located in the center console of the victim's vehicle and thus could not have been touched by your client unless he was actually in the vehicle. So we actually have that. In addition to that, we have the victim's testimony that your client did not have authorization or permission to be in that vehicle. If we take those two things and couple it with the fingerprints, then we don't have just the fingerprints, we have the fingerprints plus. Why isn't that enough to convict?
I'd like to address two different points of that. First being whether or not he would have had access to the box prior to it going into the vehicle. There's actually no testimony in the record that discusses where that box came from. We don't know if he got it at a yard sale. We don't know if he got it brand new. There is nothing in the record to suggest that that box wasn't accessible to the general public prior to his using it. It would have been 1 year from the date of the event. He said he had it in his car for a year. And so I don't think the Commonwealth asked that question. They didn't properly exclude the hypotheses that the fingerprint could have been placed on the box prior
to. But isn't the Commonwealth's burden to prove culpability, not to disprove lack of culpability?
It is their burden to, in a situation where fingerprints are your only evidence, it is their burden to exclude a reasonable hypothesis of innocence, as in other cases, where there was no testimony as to when the fingerprint could have been laid on a jar, for example.
Why would it be a reasonable hypothesis to think the defendant or the general public would have access to a coin box kept inside a private car that's usually locked, or at least locked when it goes to the mall?
There's
and If the general public doesn't go running around sticking their hands in the console boxes and then putting their fingerprints, why would they just disregard that? That's just not a reasonable inference, which is perfectly within the province of a fact finder.
If I may back up to the statement that the car is usually locked, that's actually not in the record either.
Even if it's not locked. I don't leave my car locked, but I don't expect the general public to come around putting their fingerprints on a coin box kept in the center console of that car. And I think most people think that would be a reasonable thing to expect.
I agree, Your Honor. I think it's reasonable to expect that wouldn't happen, but that doesn't mean that the box isn't accessible at that point to the general public. It doesn't mean that it's legally accessible. It doesn't mean someone has the authorization or the right to enter the vehicle. But if a car is left unlocked, and frankly, if it's out of habit left unlocked, you have more opportunity for someone to enter the vehicle and touch your stuff.
But can't you just decide that's just not a reasonable inference to draw in this circumstance?
Well,
and if it's not a reasonable inference, then it's not something you have to consider or be proved.
But Your Honor, reasonable inferences must be drawn from the record. And the Commonwealth's record does not provide the reasonable inference that someone else could not have been in this vehicle, or that his fingerprint wasn't placed at a time other than the crime.
Well, it's the premise of your argument that you think this is only a fingerprint is the only evidence, whereas based on the questions that have been posed to you, it's not the only evidence. It's the car, where, the time, all that type thing. So this is not a simple case of you can't convict only on a fingerprint. You've got a good bit more than just a fingerprint.
Your Honor, the evidence that the Commonwealth affirmatively proved and the trial court was that a fingerprint was on a movable cash box within the victim's vehicle, that they proved that fingerprints can last a long time, they proved that you cannot tell the timing of when a print was made on an item, and they proved that other people have had access to the vehicle, i.e. the valet park and i.e. the mechanical repairs in recent past. There was no evidence that Winslow was ever in that parking garage. There was no evidence that when the fingerprint was placed, there was no evidence that the fingerprint was placed when the cash box was in the car. There was no evidence as to the location and accessibility of the cash box.
Don't we have to look at the circumstances existing? I think you would have a better case if this were a situation where, say, we're talking about Judge Kelsey's car, and I was a friend of Judge Kelsey, and I had been in his car, and my fingerprints were on the cash box in his car because I was in the car with him at that time. That might provide me some level of inculpability with regard to that situation. But here we don't have that connection that seems to be necessary to say, okay, my client's fingerprints may be on that metal box, but we have an explanation or justification of why his fingerprints might have been on that metal box.
I believe that was brought into evidence, which explanation, valet parking and mechanical repairs.
Did your client ever valet park the car?
The Commonwealth didn't ask the question.
Did your client ever provide any mechanical repairs to that car?
The Commonwealth didn't ask the question.
But doesn't that circle back, and I'm not trying to be difficult, but doesn't that circle back to the statement that I made earlier that it is not the Commonwealth's responsibility to prove, disprove lack of culpability?
I think when it comes into evidence that there was other opportunity, the Commonwealth had the duty to rebut the evidence with its own witness. Did you ever see this person valet park your car? Did you ever see this person? Did you ever, and ask the questions around to at least generate some, but that didn't happen in this case.
Can I interrupt? It's my last question on the subject, but on the earlier conversation we had about the concession argument, whether it could be really contextualized as in the alternative point, I'm having trouble understanding it that way because the oral argument, which is 117 and 118, it is, may it please the court, our position, Your Honor, with respect to the motion is that ... the court did not have sufficient evidence to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Winslow had taken what would be the bulk of the grand larceny offense, which would have been the laptop computers out of the back seat. The very next paragraph, this court should have found him guilty of petty larceny and not grand larceny. It's not an alternative argument at all. That is an argument, and it's unqualified. So I figured, okay, maybe the written statement is different. I went to that. That's page 6 and 7. In Mr. Winslow's case, the evidence presented by the evidence was not sufficient to sustain a conviction. Specifically, the Commonwealth failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Winslow committed grand larceny by taking the laptops located out of the backseat of the vehicle. And then 3 sentences later, the evidence shows at best petty larceny. So how am I misreading this? I mean, I can't understand how that is not telling the trial judge that, look, there's a prima facie case of petty. You should have convicted him of that. But the grand larceny, you went too far. Which is not a bad argument to a trial court. I mean, that's actually the way you argue cases to trial courts.
So,
but on appeal, you're asking us to reverse the petty because there's no evidence that he took the $20.
So if I went with that argument for a brief moment, then what is the sufficiency of the evidence for the laptop? There's nothing in the record. That shows that he knew the laptops were in the car when
right,
he left.
The problem is the cascading nature of circumstances. If we accept the concession that, yeah, he went into the car while it was in the mall parking lot, he took the money out, but the laptop disappeared simultaneously at that exact time, but he had nothing to do with it, that attenuated inference is crazy stretched out.
The concession
actually amps up the circumstances for the laptops. Do you follow me?
I absolutely do. But I would argue the Commonwealth does not have the evidence in the record. They did not ask the witness, when was the last time you saw the laptops in Arlington? When was the last time? Were the laptops ever placed in the vehicle? The last time he testified he saw the laptops was at work in Fairfax County, in Tyson's Corner. He never testified he knew he saw the laptops in the vehicle when he got to Arlington.
Was that the same day?
Yes, it was a commute.
He left work to go to the mall.
Correct.
So he saw it there. He came out of his office or whatever with a laptop, threw it in the back seat, went to the.
That's not on the record.
Okay.
So
but
the issue that we're having here is.
Let me make sure I'm understanding. I don't want to get my facts wrong. But he says, I had it with me when I left work, in the car. It was in the car.
He said the last time that he saw, court's indulgence. I want to give you the exact words.
You're into your, well, you've expired altogether, but we've asked you so many questions. We'll give you 2 minutes on rebuttal, and you can perhaps find the citations then.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, I'm Susan Baumgartner for the Commonwealth, and I can direct the court and counsel to pages 38 and 39 of the appendix, where the victim testified that as he was leaving work, he placed the laptops in the case. He went directly to his car. He placed the laptops in the car. He drove directly to the mall, and he discovered they were gone after he got back to his car. Now, the defendant is correct in this case that he was not required to explain how his prints got on the metal box. But he is free to do as he did, sit silent at trial and offer no explanation for how his fingerprint got on a metal box inside a closed
but
console.
Just as the defendant has the absolute right to sit silent and not say anything about the evidence as presented, it is not the Commonwealth's responsibility to prove or disprove lack of culpability on the part of the defendant, is there?
Absolutely. The victim in this case at page 48 of the appendix did testify. He did not know the defendant. He had never seen him other than at trial. The defendant had no permission to enter his vehicle. To his knowledge, the defendant had never entered his vehicle or touched his cash box. Those are the questions the Commonwealth asked. Anything more, whether the defendant ever worked for a valet service, whether he ever worked for a mechanic, was uniquely within the defendant's knowledge. He didn't have to testify. However,
so basically what you're saying is that it's in the nature of an affirmative defense, the defendant could choose to present to the fact finder or choose not to present to the fact finder.
Exactly. Virginia law is clear when a fact finder can reasonably infer that the print was left by a criminal agent. There's 3 parts of that test: the location, whether the defendant had reason to be at the scene or touch the object, and whether the object was accessible to the general public. If those three are met, then there's a reasonable inference. And as the court said in the Turner case, the prosecution is not required to affirmatively and conclusively prove to a certainty that the print could not have been made other than at a time when the crime was committed. There's a wealth of Virginia law on this topic. There's no need to go to federal courts, particularly federal courts of different circuits, when Virginia law directly addresses this. For the location.
Particularly when that law is not supportive of the position.
Yes. There is, first, the location. The print was from the exterior of the metal box back by the hinge. The money was taken from the box. There's a reasonable inference that whoever stole that money touched that box by having a hinge. It apparently had a lid. There was $20 in coins and bills fished out of the box, but Egyptian coins and bills were left behind. So it's reasonable to infer that the box was touched when the money was taken out of it. Just like in the Ricks case, where pennies were taken from a jar. Accordingly, there's a link between the defendant and the stolen money, and the laptops were stolen at the same time. Also, did the defendant have any reason to be in the complainant's car or touching the box? And no, he didn't. If he had a right to be in the car, as I said, it was uniquely within his knowledge. And
there's somewhat of an undercurrent, at least in the trial court level, that you know, someone else may have done this, and maybe the defendant was with him or not with him, but as I read the trial court record, the motion in limine was granted on that point. I mean, the defendant wanted to exclude the evidence that he and his brother went to that parking lot and was seen in various vehicles on other occasions.
Yes, I believe there was another time he was caught with his brother stealing from cars, and that was not.
But that was all, that motion in limine was granted, right?
Correct, that was excluded. And then the issue is whether this was an accessible area, the third point. And the fact that this was a readily movable object is irrelevant because the evidence was that the box didn't move for a year. There was evidence that they weren't sure exactly when the fingerprints were left, but there was no evidence of just how long fingerprints could stay on. And the console itself was closed, not visible. This money was not visible from the outside. A valet and mechanic would have no reason to be inside. The car was closed. It's unclear if it was locked because there was no evidence that it was broken into. However, the victim remembered hitting his key fob, so perhaps he accidentally left it unlocked. That doesn't make it accessible because it's still a crime to go into someone else's car and start rifling through it if they forget to lock it in a parking lot. The defendant's argument is essentially, if I have a friend over to my house and I let the meter reader in, then random strangers can come in and start going through my medicine cabinet. That's not the law here. Therefore, there was sufficient
evidence. Well, truly, they're not saying that. They're saying that we don't know. Maybe there's some bizarre circumstance in which this young man had some reason to be inside that car, inside the console, putting his hands on the money box.
Right, and somehow if the victim forgot to lock it, they're arguing that it's okay for other people to go into it, and maybe the defendant.
Well, they're not saying it's okay.
It's
saying maybe he did that, but he saw the computers and he saw the money and said, you know what, I shouldn't have done this. Put it back and leave. And then somebody else come in and take it.
I just don't think that's a reasonable inference, Your Honor. I don't think that's a reasonable inference that can be drawn from his fingerprint in the location it was in this case.
There are a litany, and Judge Kelsey makes a very good point, there are a litany of circumstances that could suggest the defendant was in the car. I'm sitting here thinking, and I know from time to time I will see somebody's lights left on in the parking lot, and I'll say, wow, they're gonna burn their battery out, and the thought goes to my mind, maybe I should reach in there and turn the lights off if I see the car is unlocked, and quite frankly, I have done that because that's just the way I kind of operate my little weird world. But in the circumstances of this case, there is nothing to suggest that the defendant had any authorization, prerogative, or anything to be in that car other than to commit the crime that he was convicted of.
Absolutely. And the fingerprints weren't just in some, they weren't on the lights. They weren't on the window. They were inside a closed console on the money box from which the money was stolen. If there are no further questions, I urge you to affirm.
Thank you. Counsel, you have 2 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. And I, referring to the point, what the client, what the victim actually stated was that the question to him was, when had you last seen the laptops? He answered, when I packed them in a case around 6 o'clock when I left for work. Just want to clarify, this was not testimony that he last saw them in the car. And I think there is much discussion about authorization, and I don't think authorization is the issue here. It doesn't matter if he was authorized or not. The question is, when was the print laid?
Really, the question is, what hypothesis could possibly explain him going into that vehicle under any scenario and putting his hands? I mean, for example, Judge Olson's hypothetical is a good one. Sometimes you might go into someone else's car to, you know, retrieve a child who's, you know, left in the car or something, or the lights are on. But going into the console and starting to hold the money box, why would anyone ever do that? Even conceivably do that? What would be the point of that?
Even if there had been multiple occasions before where he had had the access, the Commonwealth is actually required to show that to have some evidence to show that the fingerprint happened at the time of the crime. And I think their evidence, as I started to go through it, affirmatively shows that their fingerprint expert testified that there's no way to determine. And additionally, the Commonwealth had mentioned his prints weren't on the windshield or the lights or whatnot. They didn't fingerprint anything but the box. So we don't know where else his fingerprints may have been. And I think the Commonwealth has not met its burden in showing that the fingerprint happened at the time of the crime, and that's the issue that we are left with today.
All right, fair enough. We appreciate your argument. We'll greet the two of you and then take up the GHS